Today's podcast is brought to you by Newspapers.com, your portal to the past. If you're like me and can't get enough of untold stories and forgotten tales, you're in for a treat. Newspapers.com has nearly a billion pages of historical newspapers dating back to the 1690s, and you can search them all in seconds. It's a treasure trove waiting for curious minds like yours. And with papers from across the US, UK, Canada, Australia, and beyond, Newspapers.com is the ultimate resource to unearth the stories that shaped our world. And here's something special for our history-loving listeners. Newspapers.com is offering an exclusive discount. Use the code HISTORYUNPLUGGED and get 20% off your subscription. That's promo code HISTORYUNPLUGGED, one word, at Newspapers.com. It's like having your own time machine to explore the stories that made history come alive. One more time, HISTORYUNPLUGGED, promo code at Newspapers.com.
Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid: high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable. It's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals, and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Hi, everyone. Welcome to our special series on the most important battles in the Civil War. The Civil War is heating up. It is not going to be a 90-day affair, as Lincoln previously hoped. We looked at the border states in the previous episode, and also the war in the West in 1861 and 1862, how Kentucky has mostly lost the Confederacy. Now we're going to look at a battle that you've probably heard of. That is the Battle of Shiloh. So James, how does this all start?
Well, so we had talked about Albert Sidney Johnston, who was the overall commander of Confederate forces west of the Appalachians. So he had a huge theater of war going all the way from eastern Kentucky all the way over to Arkansas. And his job had been to, his initial assignment was to maintain a line that went roughly through southern Kentucky, stretched all the way actually from Arkansas to the Cumberland Gap, which is in extreme eastern Kentucky. And Grant's victories at Fort Henry and Fort Donelson, and if y'all haven't listened to that one, I would strongly suggest you go back and listen to the episode we did on that prior to this one. Grant captured Fort Henry, Fort Donelson, which were in Tennessee, which made Kentucky untenable for the Confederates. So as you mentioned, Albert Sidney Johnston had to pull the Confederate line down out of Kentucky and into extreme southern Tennessee. Just to remind everybody, even though the South has an overall commander for the entire Western theater in Albert Sidney Johnston, the North doesn't yet have one overall commander. They're about to, spoiler alert. but where we left off, you had General Henry Halleck. His nickname, I forgot to mention this last time, nickname was Old Brains. He was really more of an organizer, a paper pusher, an administrator, not famous as a great leader of men on the field of battle. But he was smart enough to pick a man named Ulysses S. Grant to go out and actually do the fighting. And Grant, as we saw, took Henry and Donelson, Forts Henry and Fort Donelson. The Union commander in the eastern part of the West, that's kind of an oxymoron, isn't it? The eastern West. But let's say the middle, like from the Appalachians west to roughly halfway across Tennessee. His name was Don Carlos Buell. So that's the situation where we left off last time. Now, Jefferson Davis, well, let's actually back up a step. our listeners may remember who was the commander here. Let's play trivia. Who was the commander of the Confederate troops that fired on Fort Sumter? And then he also went and was the commander of the Southern Army at First Bull Run. Anybody remember?
People are quickly pausing frantically to then go to Google. So
I'll give you 5 seconds. No, I think I heard somebody say General Beauregard. Yeah, I see that hand.
Yep.
All right. General PGT Beauregard. Well, Beauregard, we last left him on the field at Bull Run or Manassas, where he and Joseph Johnston had whipped the Yankees and sent them back packing to Washington, running to Washington. Anyway, Beauregard fell afoul of Jefferson Davis, so Jefferson Davis sent him out west to help General Albert Sidney Johnston. So he and Johnston are going to kind of co-run the war now in the West for the Confederates, although Johnston is still the senior commander. Beauregard decides to concentrate the forces that he was given at a city called Corinth. And Corinth, not the Corinth in Greece, like that's mentioned in the Bible. But this is Corinth, Mississippi, which is a key railroad junction. It controls, it's in northeastern Tennessee, but that's in the notes. That's incorrect. It's actually in Mississippi. And it's northern Mississippi. But anyway, Johnston is ordered to go down and join him. So all the Confederate troops are going to concentrate around Corinth, Mississippi. And then Halleck, now old brains, he is put in charge of the entire Western theater. Okay, so now we do have one commander. So Buell now reports to him, as does Grant. So you've got Halleck is the overall guy in charge of the Union troops in the West, and he has under him Grant with one army and Buell with another army. Buell is up in Kentucky, and Grant is he's just defeated Fort Donelson. And anyway, so Halleck orders Ulysses S. Grant to march down to a city called Pittsburg Landing, which is on the Tennessee River in southwestern Tennessee, and it's just north of Corinth. So let's do our mental map again. I'll try to do as many of these as I can. Remember that Tennessee is shaped roughly like a box, but it's slanted on the two sides. The northern boundary and the southern boundary run east-west. The western boundary is roughly north-south, and that is the Mississippi River. The city of Memphis is there. The Tennessee River runs also roughly north and south, and it's east of the Mississippi River. So Grant goes down the Tennessee River, and he goes to this town called Pittsburg Landing, which is west, or if you're looking at a map, it's going to be to the left of the Tennessee River. So he lays out his forces there, and the river is at his back. But Buell is also commanded. Halleck tells General Buell to go down and join Grant to reinforce him so that the it's better to have your forces combined in one place, because they realize the Confederates are getting restless. The Confederates are not happy about losing Tennessee, and they want to get it back, obviously. So Halleck and Grant know that they're about to be attacked, and Buell is getting down there as fast as he can. Actually, to be honest with you, they really wanted Grant. Halleck wanted Grant and Buell, once Buell got there, to go and attack the Confederates in Corinth. In other words, just keep the momentum going, take the fight to the Southerners. But Grant is waiting for Buell to join him. So he camps with the river to his back, and he camps near a place called Shiloh. It's a church, actually. There's a church called Shiloh, and this is another great irony. I love to point this out. Shiloh is a Hebrew term, which means the place of peace. So, but there is not going to be a lot of peace in this spot. All right, I want to take just a minute before we get into the battle to give a little bit of Grant. I want to sketch him out and give a little mini bio. Grant had a very interesting background. He was a West Pointer. He didn't really want to go to West Point. He hated it at West Point. Didn't do particularly great in his classes. He graduated toward the middle of his class. One thing he was very good at was horsemanship. He was kind of like a proto horse whisperer. Very good with riding horses, very good at talking and calming horses down. After he graduated, Grant was a lieutenant, and he went and served in the Mexican War. He was assigned. He served under General Zachary Taylor and then later under General Winfield Scott, and served with honor down there. He was sent out west without his family, which that was really dumb of the Army to do that, to send these poor guys out without their family. But, you know, it was hard. Transportation was very difficult back in those days, as we touched on last time. Grant was very lonely. He was very depressed. He was bored. And so that's when he started his drinking. And honestly, nobody knows the extent to which Grant drank, how much he drank. What I've read is that he didn't handle his liquor very well, so he could drink just a little bit and get intoxicated pretty easily. He did like whiskey. And what happens ultimately is that he's accused of being a drunkard, and he's forced to resign from the Army. He wasn't too sad about leaving the Army. So he quits the Army in 1854. He moves back he bounces around between Missouri, St. Louis, and also he ends up in Illinois. And he fails in several careers. He tries to start a farm, and that doesn't work out. He tries business, that doesn't work. And he ends up being a clerk in his father's store when he's 39 years old. How humiliating. His father was a tanner, somebody who worked with animal skins, and Grant absolutely despised that. He couldn't stand the smell. Isn't that funny? This guy that's going to become this great general, he can't stand blood and guts and the smell of animal hides. But he ends up being a clerk, and then when the war breaks out, he volunteers to rejoin the Army, and he's made a colonel and then a brigadier general, and then General Halleck gives him his first break. He took a battle called Belmont, which is in Missouri, which was actually a loss, but he fought really aggressively and did well and got some attention. He took Paducah, Kentucky, and then last time we saw how he took Fort Henry and Donelson. And he earned the nickname Unconditional Surrender Grant because he had demanded the commander of the Confederate fort at Fort Donelson to, he said, the terms, my surrender terms are unconditional surrender. In other words, you don't get to call the shots. I call the shots. All right, so that's a little bit about Grant. Could say much more about Grant, but we will as we go on through the course. Not the course. This is not a course. This is a series of podcasts. It could be, I guess, but
there you go. We could spin it off. Who knows?
That's right. All right. So your first test, students, is no, I'm just kidding. So we also talked in our last I almost said lecture. In our last episode, we talked about how the Confederacy had this really nice railroad going through northern Alabama, northern Mississippi, east, west, that they could use to shift troops around. And Corinth was kind of the place where it went off in several directions. So Corinth is an extremely important city. By early April, Grant had about 42,000 troops, while Johnston and Beauregard had about 40,000. So not much of a difference. But what was going to make the difference, or what could make the difference, was Buell. Buell is coming down from Kentucky, coming down through Tennessee. He has 20,000 troops. So if Grant and Buell can join up, they will have 60,000 to 42,000 under the Confederates, and then they're going to attack Corinth and hopefully drive the Confederates further south, or maybe even possibly destroy the Army or capture a lot of the people. And the Confederates know this. They realize if Buell arrives, if we just sit around and wait for Buell to join Grant, and then he's going to go from having 40,000 to 60,000, we're in big trouble. So let's hit him before Buell can actually get there. So they decide to attack Grant before he can be reinforced by Buell.
One date I know with Shiloh is April 6th. So what happens then, and what happens in the days leading up to that?
Sure. So as I mentioned, Albert Sidney Johnston and Beauregard are both pretty aggressive generals, and they're not going to just sit around and wait. So they start marching towards Grant. They're trying to surprise the Bluecoats. And Albert Sidney Johnston kind of had a flair for the dramatic, and he said, I would fight them if they were a million, which let's not take him too literally.
He can see that in some marble on the side of a building in the future. So he's just shouting at posterity at this point.
Yeah, it's a great quote, you know, not very realistic. But so they leave. They set off on April 3rd, actually, hoping to attack by the 4th or the 5th. But they're plagued by muddy roads. We've already talked about how terrible roads were back in the 1860s. And if you got a decent amount of rain, they just turned into mush. Grant's army had the Tennessee River to their back, so retreat is not an option. Grant that's highly motivating, isn't it? You've got to fight, or either that or you drown or you surrender. The Confederates then marched forward in four lines, and they were very inexperienced. A lot of these men had never fought in combat before, and we can never underestimate the importance of that. They didn't even get in place until the afternoon of April 5th, so it takes them 2 days to get up there, and they make a great deal of noise on the way. They need to be quiet, but these are rookies, right? And so they don't understand that, and they're practicing their rebel yells, and they're shooting at squirrels, and they're doing all kinds of goofball stuff. That kind of stuff will not happen later, but now it does. Now, so you would think that the Union soldiers, at least somebody would hear this, all this racket that the Confederates are making, but it doesn't happen that way. Somehow the Federals are completely surprised. They were sitting there eating breakfast, and all of a sudden here come, you know, tens of thousands of screaming rebels. They're screaming that rebel yell, that high-pitched yell, and so they drop their pancakes and try to find their their guns and, you know, make sure you're awake and dressed. So complete surprise. The Federals are caught completely off guard. The Confederates push the Federals back. They're very successful at first. They push them back towards the river. Johnston said to his commanders, he said, "Gentlemen, tonight we water our horses in the Tennessee River." So again, imagine this. The river is, if you were thinking of a map, the river would be at the top of the map. And then just south or below the river are the Union troops all lined out. They're struggling to get into position, struggling to get organized. At the bottom of the map, at the south, moving north pretty quickly, are the rebels. And they're fighting and they're pushing back the completely surprised Union troops. I don't know, I think we mentioned this last time, but there was a rumor, of course, that went around that the reason Grant was surprised is because he was drinking, but there's probably no truth to that rumor. But anyway, so the fighting occurs, and the fighting is very savage. It's brutal. You've got all these tens of thousands of men at pretty close range, and they're in a very pretty small area. The Federals keep giving back. They give way on their right and on their left. But in the center, they held strong, and they're in an oak thicket, and it comes to be called the Hornet's Nest. And it's called that for two reasons. One, because it's just the center of really intense fighting. And two, because the sound of bullets whizzing by, it's compared to the sound of a hornet flying around. A lot of bluecoats, Union troops, they retreat in panic, but Grant remains calm. And that was one of the great strengths of General Grant, is he never panicked. He never lost his cool. And so you basically got, if you think of the Union line, let's do another mental map. Think of it as just a line going from east to west. The right side and the left side are backing away. It's almost like it's folding in on itself. Think of it as a book that's been flattened out, and then somebody starting to close the book. And so you've got just the center left, the center remaining. Now, the Confederates could have made major progress if they had gone over to the right and tried to go around the Union troops and move along the river. They could have pushed the Union back and separated the Union troops from the river and blocked Buell's troops. Buell's troops are coming, but they're going to have to cross the river to get in and join Grant's troops. But instead, they go where the fighting is. The fighting is in the Hornet's Nest, which is in the middle of the line. And for hours and hours, the brave Union troops there hold off the Confederate attack, which is really savage. And by 5 p.m., the Confederates finally capture the Hornet's Nest. So the day's almost over. This is April, so it's going to get dark, you know, pretty soon after 5 p.m., maybe 6:30. And the Confederates capture 2,000 men, and they push the Federals back to a new position near Pittsburg Landing, the town that's around the river. But unfortunately for the Confederates, they have a major disaster occur, and that is that the overall commander, the head honcho of the Army, General Albert Sidney Johnston, is killed. Now, one thing that I think probably most of our listeners know, but just in case— Civil War combat was organized so that generals led from the front and officers led from the front. If you think about World War II, Like Eisenhower didn't actually jump out onto the beaches in Normandy. Come on, man, let's go.
He was a beachmaster. Yeah.
You're right. Yeah. I mean, not even, you know, Omar Bradley, who was the head field commander. He was not like out in the front. The generals.
Come on, man, Patton.
Yeah. Well, Patton, he was a different character there, but even Patton, you know, they tended to stay back and they didn't want the generals to be killed. But it was different in the Civil War. You led from the front. And so Albert Sidney Johnston was riding up and down, rallying the troops, you know, spurring them on, getting them to attack. Come on, boys, keep giving it to them. And all of a sudden, one of Johnston's staff members sees he starts to reel in the saddle. He's kind of swaying back and forth. And he runs up to him and he says, "General, are you hurt?" And he says, "Yes, and I fear, I'm seriously hurt." And then they get Johnston down from the horse and they look at one of his boots and like it's completely full of blood and blood is coming out of the boot. And they look at him again and they realize that he had been nicked behind the knee. A bullet had basically cut his femoral artery, which is hard to survive. Right. However, I think a simple tourniquet probably would have saved his life, but Johnston had sent his own personal medic or surgeon off to aid some Union prisoners. So for lack of a tourniquet, Albert Sidney Johnston dies. And so the Confederates lose their senior commander. And keep in mind, too, he is the second ranking general and the senior field general in the entire Confederacy. So he's going to be, and he's a 4-star general. He's a full general. And so he is he's going to be the highest ranking officer on either side to be killed in battle. So anyway, with Johnston dead, this happens around 2 or 3 in the afternoon. Command passes to Beauregard. Beauregard decides to halt the attack and resume it the next day. He thought that General Van Dorn, who was in Arkansas, he thought he was going to be marching over, and he didn't think Buell was going to make it. Remember, Buell's trying to reinforce Grant with 20,000 right. more troops. Beauregard actually wired Jefferson Davis, and he said, "I've won a great victory." He says, "I'll finish it tomorrow." And how many times has this happened? We've already seen this where one side declares victory and the other side, not so fast. Now, Grant, at the end of the day, both sides just kind of, they camp out, they take a break, because there wasn't a lot of fighting at night back in these days. They didn't have night vision goggles, obviously, and it was very wooded. It was hard to see. There's a lot of smoke on the battlefield because the guns, the rifles and the pistols and everything, they put out smoke. So you didn't see a lot of fighting at night. And so both sides are going to take a break. They're going to try to care for the wounded. And Grant's right-hand man, we haven't met this gentleman yet, but we're going to talk a lot about him in the future. His name is General William T. Sherman. Sherman was a trusted subordinate of Grant. He was very much like Grant, in at least in the way that he was very aggressive. Sherman goes up to Grant and he says, "Well, Grant, we've had the devil's own day, haven't we?" And Grant just looks at him and he says, "Yep, looking tomorrow, though." That's Grant in a nutshell right there. That's just the way he was, calm, cool, and collected, and irrepressible, determined to get victory. And we're going to see a lot of other Union generals are the exact opposite.
Grant went pretty far in Presidential Fight Club. I mean, just to make a callback to our previous series, but
Check it out, people, Presidential Fight Club.
PresidentialFightClub.com. Well, he went a number of rounds, and not so much for his physical ability, but the respect that he had from listeners for his abilities as a grand unified strategist and understanding every part of the battle, which is a criticism against Lee. Don't want to give away too much of that. But hey, let's not slow down this battle. So what happens the next day?
Okay, so the next day, April 7th, all night, there's a thunderstorm raging. There's lightning flashing. Wounded men are screaming. They're crying for help. As the lightning lights up the landscape, some of the troops look around and they see a horrible sight. They see pigs walking around the battlefield feasting on the dead. It's just hellish. It's awful. There were so many people killed on the first day that General Grant said it was possible to walk across the battlefield in any direction, stepping on bodies without a foot touching the ground. So instead of having grass, you have bodies as basically the ground or the floor. Fortunately for the Union and unfortunately for the Confederacy, Buell's army reaches Grant's position during the night. They cross the river. 20,000 fresh troops are ferried over, and they join up with Grant. So Grant now has way more troops than the rebels do. And at this point, we'll introduce another interesting character. There's so many cool characters and just fascinating people in the Civil War. One of the head Confederate cavalry generals was a man named Nathan Bedford Forrest. And Forrest saw, he was riding around and he saw these troops and he tried to warn his federal Confederate generals. He rode from one general's camp to another and he said, "Hey, these other troops are coming. The Yankees are here. Buell made it." And they all just said, yeah, right, whatever. They don't take him seriously. Meanwhile, General Van Dorn, the one we mentioned that was in Arkansas, he never makes it. He doesn't show up. So on the morning of the 7th, now Grant turns the tables and he launches a counterattack. And it's not real complicated. It's very simple. The Federals push the Confederates back. They win an overwhelming victory on the second day. They retake the ground that they had lost the day before. Beauregard realizes he has no chance, and so he decides to retreat. And Grant, he held the field. And Nathan Bedford Forrest, he covers the Confederate retreat. In other words, he rides between the retreating Confederates and the advancing Federals, and he makes sure that there's not going to be some kind of rout, although the Union troops are worn out, and they're especially Grant's original troops. And there's not really much chance that there's going to be much of a pursuit. But there's an interesting story about Forrest. Forrest rides out and he finds himself surrounded by by Union infantry. And these guys are saying, kill the damn rebel, kill him. And he picks up, he leans down and he grabs with one hand, he grabs a Union soldier, puts him behind him on the horse, facing the other way. This is like something out of a movie, like a Western, you know, when they pick up a guy and put him on the horse and he rides away and he's shielding himself. So as he's riding away, the Federal troops can't shoot Forrest because if they do, they'll shoot their own man. And then they drop and he drops him down and he gets away. So Forrest is going to live to cause the Union a lot of headaches in the future. But that's a fascinating story because that's something you see in a movie and you say, yeah, right, that's ridiculous. But it really did happen in this case.
Yeah, Forrest is interesting. I don't believe he had combat experience before the Civil War, but he was so effective as a cavalry commander that there were times where Confederate force numbers are grossly overestimated because of his shock tactics that would make some Union battlefield commanders assume that they had much stronger numbers for someone to pull off attack like that. So he's called a wizard in a saddle, which leads infamously after the Civil War when he founds the Ku Klux Klan, the honorary title of Grand Wizard. Now, apologists of Forrest in the South would argue that the Ku Klux Klan in its most violent iteration in the 1920s was a mutation of what happened from its earliest iteration. Now, I'm not going to go back and forth here because I'm not terribly interested in defending the Ku Klux Klan. But with Nathan Bedford Forrest, he is credited by many as being a highly active cavalry commander. And I can't say this definitively, but some have said that Erwin Rommel in World War II studied the tactics of Nathan Bedford Forrest. So apparently he was quite respected even internationally, at least on the battlefield.
Yeah, I'm not a big expert on Rommel, but that wouldn't surprise me. I mean, like you said, Forrest had no military experience, not a well-educated man. He was very wealthy. He'd made a lot of money selling slaves and selling real estate and cotton and things like that. But it just goes to show that you cannot predict how good a general is going to be based on their experience, because we're going to see a lot of people who went to West Point and they were brilliant. They graduated near the top of their class and they stink as a general. And then others, like, you know, Grant went to West Point, but he wasn't very good with his classes. He didn't shine academically and he turns into a terrific general. So, and then you get some political generals who are appointed because they're the governor of a key state or whatever. And they are awful. And then you get others that are actually pretty good. So it's kind of like, I think of it as like, like when you're an NFL franchise, right? Let's say you end up and you get the first draft. And so you pick this great quarterback who broke all these records in college. And how many times have we seen these guys flop in the NFL? You know, it's just hard to predict.
Right.
Anyway, I'm getting off. Sorry, football.
Well, I mean, it is part of the romanticism, I think, of the Civil War, where somebody can come seemingly out of nowhere and become this brilliant commander. And then somebody else wilts, and you might say it's cowardice, and almost as if saying the Civil War was this outsized contest where it wasn't men but gods that caused even great generals to quake in fear. Well, maybe that general had never seen battle, and I'd like to think the armed forces does a much better job of preparing people and training them until before they get to the highest levels of command.
Oh, yeah. Today it's way more professional.
Oh, yeah.
We have to keep in mind that, not to get too far off of the topic here, but I mean, it's relevant. Even these guys that had been to West Point, like a Grant or like a, you know, a McClellan or Robert E. Lee, these men had never commanded armies like these ones they're now in charge of. Okay. Most of them had been company commanders. They'd commanded 100 people, you know, or maybe 1,000 in a few cases, but right, and a lot of them, like Halleck, had just been paper pushers, like Irvin McDowell that we saw last time at Bull Run. Nobody had the experience of leading an army of 50,000 men, 70,000 men, 100,000 men. So they're having to learn it as they go.
And like you said in the first episode, the U.S. military is very small before the Civil War, so there simply aren't that many opportunities for commanding large armies. So we can't blame them, as opposed to today, where there are over a million soldiers in the different branches of the military serving. So you have plenty of opportunities to command before you get very high. But we'll not get blown too far afield. So could you kind of lay out the outcome and also the consequences of Shiloh?
Sure. It's an extremely bloody battle. The Confederates suffer about 11,000 casualties, which includes about 1,700 killed, 8,000 wounded, and about 950 captured or missing. The Union loses even more. They lose 13,000, 1,800 killed, 8,400 wounded, and 2,900 captured and missing. And the big difference there is the captured and missing. We remember how we talked about in the hornet's nest in the middle of the field on the first day, you had 200 Union soldiers who were captured, but they bought a lot of time for Grant, and they helped make sure that it wasn't a disaster and that the Union troops did not get pushed into the river. So, you know, just appalling, unbelievably high casualties. There were more casualties at Shiloh, just this one battle in 2 days, than in all previous American battles combined. Can you imagine that?
Wow.
So you add up, I mean, even before the United States was a nation, so like add together the French and Indian War, and then the Revolutionary War, and the War of 1812, the Mexican-American War, add all those together, the Indian Wars up to that time, all of those added together, the number of casualties were less than at just this one battle in Shiloh. And also throw in the other Civil War battles to that point, too. It's just carnage on a scale that they have never seen before. And we saw among those casualties was one of the best generals on the side of the Confederacy. And as I mentioned before, the top-ranking field officer, Albert Sidney Johnston, is killed.
You can imagine a lot of counterfactual histories imagining what would happen if he hadn't been killed.
Yeah, I can. You know, I used to play this Civil War board game, and in the board game, Albert Sidney Johnston doesn't automatically get killed. So, and that can really help the South. You know, Johnston wasn't perfect. Some people have argued that he had some flaws in his philosophy of command, but I think things would have definitely gone better had he lived. This is a major blow for the South. It's very demoralizing. We've seen the South has lost Fort Henry, Fort Donelson, they lost Nashville, and now they've lost the Battle of Shiloh. And one resident of New Orleans wrote, "After Shiloh, the South never smiled again." Now, Grant's reputation as a hero was enhanced. This is Grant's third victory in a row. No other Union general really has one major victory. There's a few minor victories that have occurred, but things haven't been going well for the Union in the East, but now in the West, it seems like they're unstoppable. And Grant in particular is unstoppable. Now, some of his critics, I touched on this before, they falsely accused him of being drunk when the battle began, but he almost certainly wasn't. Another consequence is that the Union gains a firm hold on Tennessee. Tennessee is the first of the Confederate states to fall firmly into Union hands. Never again did the Confederacy have a serious chance of regaining it. They're going to try a couple more times, but it's not going to work. Spoiler alert. And actually, just as a side note, Lincoln appointed a military governor of Tennessee to rule it on behalf of the Union. And his name, perhaps you've heard of this guy, Andrew Johnson. He will have, I don't know if I want to say a big future, but he's got a lot, a big role to play in future American history. Andrew Johnson was a senator from Tennessee when Tennessee seceded, and he refused to go with the Confederacy. He stayed loyal to the Union, and he took a lot of heat for that. Johnson, Andrew Johnson was the only, I'm sorry it's confusing, there's so many Johnsons and Johnstons, but Andrew Johnson, Senator Andrew Johnson of Tennessee, he was the only Southern senator whose state seceded, and he stayed loyal to the Union. So Lincoln rewards him. And he's going to reward him even more in 1864, but more on that later. Finally, Grant realizes that the war would have to be a war of total conquest. At the beginning of the war, we've seen that people on both sides were really hoping that it would be a quick war, you know, 90 days, maybe even less. And they were hoping it would be a limited war, meaning, you know, you just send the armies out, the armies duke it out, one of them wins, and the war is over. And it doesn't really touch the average Joe back home very much. But Grant understands now that's not going to be the war. This is going to have to be a total war. I think Grant is the first one, Grant and Sherman together realize this, and that's going to affect the way they run the war later on. Whereas other Northern generals, like, let's say, General McClellan out east, we'll talk about him next episode. McClellan still is hoping for this limited war that really doesn't have much of an impact on the overwhelming majority of the people of the South.
Right. And it's hard for even some generals late in the war to shake that provincialism of focusing exclusively on Virginia or some other state and not really keeping the focus on the total war effort, which I think Grant, to his credit, really does do a good job of.
Yeah, Grant gets the big picture, and he gets it early on, and that's going to pay off for him later.
Well, I mean, speaking of total war, I think it is worth looking at these different areas. And in the last episode, we looked at developments in the West. So what are subsequent developments that happened in the West?
Yeah, we'll wrap up a few more things that are going to happen in the West. And then, sorry about that. Then next time we will go back East, spend some time there. But things continue to go very poorly for the South and very well for the North. On April 25th, so this is just 18 days after Shiloh's over, a combined Union Army and Navy capture New Orleans, which is the largest city in the Confederacy and the gateway to the Mississippi River. So that's huge. That is a big blow to the Confederacy. Let's save the Halleck and Corinth. Let's save that for the last. In June, another Union force captures Memphis. And I didn't even mention there was a general named John Pope who captured a city named, or a, I guess it's a city, or maybe a fort, Island Number 10, which is on the Mississippi. So the Federals, the Yankees, the Union Army and Navy, they're just one by one picking off all these cities on the Mississippi River. And it gets to where the Union, by the summer of 1862, you know, only about a year after Bull Run, the North controls almost all of the Mississippi already. So that's really bad for the South. The one exception is the city of Vicksburg and the area around it, and that's going to be a major goal of Grant in the future. But for now, the South is very depressed about what's going on in the West. It's just one thing after another. Beauregard is removed from command. Okay, Beauregard, there's several generals we're going to see. They just keep getting shifted around from place to place. Beauregard is one of those. He's going to actually end up going back east again. But and then we'll talk about this. I'll just set it up, and then you had some stuff you wanted to say about Halleck. Halleck, remember, this is the man, listeners, who is the he's the overall commander of all Union troops in the West, and he's this very much a desk general, no combat experience. He wrote a lot of books. He was very academically gifted, but no combat experience. He decides to come south himself. He wants to personally take command. So he comes down and takes over. It says to Grant and Buell, okay, you guys, step aside. I'm going to run the show now right here on the field. And he leads them to Corinth, Mississippi. That's the next goal, is they want to take Corinth. And I'll leave it. You take it from there.
Yeah, this is something I want to underline, and I mentioned it briefly in the last episode, but James reminded me not to spoil anything. But he goes very, very slow. You could barely even call it a campaign, the Corinth campaign in the spring of 1862. And his inability to capture the momentum after Shiloh, there's a book called The 10 Biggest Blunders of the Civil War by Edward Bonnekemper. He lists this as one of the biggest blunders, alongside the South not selling off as much of its cotton as it could before the Union blockade and being economically hampered, or the South not taking advantage of its black manpower in the form of support roles or even as soldiers, and depleting its already considerable numerical disadvantage against the Union. So anyway, with Halleck, his Corinth campaign was extremely slow. McClellan wasn't very fast either. He had sort of a tortoise-like pace. And for Halleck, I don't know if for him being a theorist and overthinking every single step, this could be the case, but he tried to move his 130,000 men in the direction of Corinth. Shiloh, just a little bit of background. Beauregard's Confederates retreat, and Corinth is where the East-West Memphis and Charleston Railroad intersected the North-South Mobile and Ohio lines, and it's crucial. It's been called the crossroads of the Western Confederacy. So he set out on April 30th, and he took 4 weeks, Halleck did, to cover 22 miles to Corinth. And Grant was very frustrated at this point. He thought this should have taken 2 days. Halleck also had a wait-and-see approach. It left the North vulnerable to Confederate counteroffenses. So Halleck missed an enormous opportunity to put 50,000 Confederate troops out of action for the war's duration. And this pace is just something that it's embarrassing. So something to keep in mind there, that this was a total war. It's not like the war would have ended, but it could have begat a sequence that could have caused it to end much more quickly. So another factor, too, to keep in mind with these generals who don't have combat experience, and when theory meets reality, you see a lot of problems.
Yeah, this is true in most wars, but I think in the Civil War, it really stands out. Is a lot of these generals, they were very proud and they were jealous. And I think I've read that Halleck was jealous of Grant. Grant's getting all the fame and all the accolades. Halleck's sitting at a desk in St. Louis, and he wants to get out there and win him a major victory and get him a nickname, like Unconditional Surrender Halleck or something like that. It would be something different, but not just Old Brains. He wanted something like Old Kick Butt. I don't know, but I'm just being silly. But the point is serious in that Halleck wanted a piece of the action. He didn't want to just be a desk general. He wanted to win a major victory, but he wasn't humble enough or didn't have the wisdom to realize that he wasn't the man for the job. That's a good leader, whether it's in war or in business or anything, they realize their strengths and their weaknesses. Halleck was great as an administrator, not so much as a field commander, but he did not realize that. He didn't understand, I really ought to just let Grant do this, because Grant clearly understands the X's and the O's of the battlefield. He understands logistics. He understands things like that, and I really don't. So maybe I should just tell Grant to do it and let him do it. But he just wasn't, I guess, a big enough man. I don't know, he was just bored in St. Louis. Being so far from the action, I think it was a combination of those factors. But yeah, if he had had the wisdom to realize that Grant was the man for the job at the time, things could have been very different.
Well, egos will continue to interfere, but reality is going to come in hard as the Civil War digs in. So in the next episode, we're going to be looking at the 1862 Peninsula campaign.
See you then.
All right, well, that was the episode for today. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you want to support the show and help me keep producing this content, there are four easy ways for you to do it. One, subscribe to the show and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you want to do that, you can go to historyunplugpodcast.com and there you'll find instructions. Two, join our Facebook group, which you can find if you just search for History Unplugged. And please like and share posts that I put up about new episodes. This helps new people discover the show on social media. Three, submit a question to me so that I can answer it on air. You can email me at info@historyonthenet.com or leave a voicemail. And again, go to historyunplugpodcast.com and you'll find instructions. Lastly, and I think this one is the best, is to join the History Unplugged membership program. You can find out how by going to patreon.com/unplugged. If you sign up, you can get early access to new podcast episodes, along with complete access to the History Unplugged archives. This is over 250 episodes, hundreds of hours of content, and access to fan favorites like Presidential Fight Club, a tournament that looks at what would happen if all U.S. presidents fought each other one-on-one. You can also get access to premium episodes, like a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, or the 10-part series Ottoman Lives, a series that looks at the cast of characters that made up the Ottoman Empire, such as the Sultan, the Eunuch, the Harem Servant Girl, and the Soldier. Plus, History Unplugged's membership program is the only history podcast that's supported by both Barack Obama and Donald Trump, along with Abraham Lincoln and Benjamin Franklin. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn why. Again, that's patreon.com/unplugged. Anyway, those are the ways you can help out the show. Thank you so much for your support. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18+.